Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining me here on my show, Uneven Distribution, where we talk to the time travelers among us, those who are living in the future and giving us insights as to what it's like. And I have the perfect guest for this kind of scenario today. My dear old friend, Leo Laporte, is here with us today. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Denise. I'm not sure how old I am, but I'm old. Yes.
Well, so am I.
We've known each other for how many, 20 years? A long time.
It's got to be 20 years. Yeah. I mean, you did your first episode of This Week in Tech, although you weren't calling it that then, in 05, right?
April 2005.
Yeah.
So we just entered our 20th year of shows. And episode 1000 is coming up in October, I think.
So, I know. Episode I was just on was 988, and it really gave me pause.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So when you say old, I mean it. I am. I live it.
Right. Well, for those of you who aren't as familiar with Leo as I am, let me do some brief introductions here. Leo is a longtime fixture in the world of radio and television and one of the original pioneers of podcasting. So I literally wouldn't be here doing this show without Leo, both as my mentor and as one of the people who made it possible for folks like the rest of us to do these shows. So Leo's career has spanned decades. He is much loved across the country and across the world from his show on KFI Radio, The Tech Guy, where he has handheld so many of us over the years as we try and navigate the technology that both aids our lives and all too often thwarts what we're trying to accomplish. And Leo has been instrumental in making sure that people can iron out their technical difficulties, if you will. I first came across you, Leo, when you were at Tech TV in San Francisco. And I was practicing law at the time and rushing home to watch my TiVo recorded episodes of Call for Help.
That's awesome. Oh,
yeah. This is how I know you. And then your other amazing show on Tech TV was called The Screensavers. And The Screensavers The Screensavers was this magnificent romp through everything that was happening in technology at the time. And this was the early 2000s, and there was a lot going on in technology at that time. And you would get, you know, people who were actively working and building the tools that, if not the tools we're using today, the tools that became the tools that we're using today. And they just wander by the studio and shoot the breeze with you and do hands-on things. It was magnificent. And so that show then morphed into, well, why don't you tell me? Because right at the beginning of podcasting, there was no Apple channel or Spotify channel or any sort of library of podcasts you could go to and pick and choose from and search. In fact, all there really was a bunch of tech enthusiasts, including Dave Weiner, who was pretty instrumental in all of this, figuring out that you could wrap an audio file in a little bit of code and that things would update such that if you put a new file there, people would get it automatically. And so you could do this sort of running show where you would just keep updating that RSS feed. What was your first encounter with that kind of technology and what went through your head at the time?
Well, as you mentioned, I was doing TV. TV kind of left me in 2004. Tech TV got sold to Comcast. And they were going to go, they had some ideas to turn it into a kind of more of a gaming network. So they got rid of everybody who was of a certain age. In other words, over 30. And I was one of them. Patrick Norton, my co-host, was another. They kept Kevin Rose because he was young. So they kept doing what they eventually called G4 Tech TV and then G4 TV. And that just kind of faded off into the distance. I was doing radio. I had kind of seen the beginning of the end coming. So that's, as you mentioned, I went to KFI. They called me and I said, yes, I'd love to do that. So I was doing a radio show on the weekends. And around 2004, You nailed it. Dave Weiner, who was the guy who created, one of the guys who created RSS, the idea that you, if you had a blog, you could have a feed on your blog that people could subscribe to. When you posted a new blog post, they'd get a notification and they could read it. RSS stands for really simple syndication, and that's what it was. The former MTV VJ Adam Curry went to Dave Weiner and said, "Hey, Dave, it'd be really cool if we could add audio to this RSS feed." And Dave said, "Well, yeah, that's not so hard." So he added what they call audio enclosures to RSS. And suddenly, not only could you subscribe to a blog, but you could subscribe to audio. Wasn't named podcasting quite yet, but pretty quickly it became podcasting, because the only way people could really, or the most common way people would listen to it, was on a iPod. So I was doing the radio show. I was already putting audio from my show on the web, so it wasn't like anything new. I was recording the show. I'd put it up hour by hour on a website. And I remember a young guy named Matthew Bischoff, who's still around, still in tech, called me up. He's about 14. He said, "Hey, have you heard of this thing called podcasting?" And I said, "No, what's that?" He explained it to me. I said, "Well, yeah, I could do that. I just have to create an RSS feed." So I did. And so the radio show in October 2004 was the first thing that I did as a podcast. But I had come from a really fun group of people at Tech TV who I really loved to talk to. I still kind of talk to them on a regular basis. So it came around eventually that we would talk, I'd record it, and we'd put it out as a podcast. It was a little difficult because I live in, like, up in the wine country in Petaluma, California, which is in Sonoma County, now well known thanks to Apple. And they all lived in LA and San Francisco and stuff. But along came this technology called Skype. Somebody called me in the radio show. And I said, "Wow, you sound really good, because they don't sound like it was on a telephone." He sounded like it was in the same room. "So what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm using Skype." And a kind of a light bulb went off. I thought, oh, we could record regularly with these guys all and gals all over the country, including this great lawyer named Denise Howell, if using Skype. And it would almost be like we were in the same room. And so that really was what made it all possible. In April 2005, I started doing, you're right, it wasn't called Twit at first. It was called The Revenge of the Screensavers, which was the old Tech TV show. Mm-hmm. And most of the people on it were former screensavers, people who had been let go by G4 Tech TV. G4 pretty quickly let me know that they weren't done with that name. And so we had to find a new name. I asked the audience, and somebody suggested This Week in Geek. And I thought, well, that's good. What if it's This Week in Tech? Then it would be funny, because it would be Twit. And I can't tell you over the years how many people have wrote me and saying, you know, Twit in England is not a nice thing to call somebody. I said, I know. Or the more obscure scholars among them, you know, Twit is a pregnant goldfish. I said, you know what? I chose the name because it was self-deprecating. I know. It was just kind of fun. And it's memorable, Twit. So ever since, we've been doing that now almost 20 years. First show was This Week in Tech, and we added shows like MacBreak Weekly and Windows Weekly and Security Now. And we slowly, I think we got up to 25 or 30 shows at one point. And we had a big 20,000 square foot studio. But, you know, podcasting has kind of had its ups and downs. It's right now, it's kind of, if you're not a B-list celebrity, it's kind of hard to succeed as a podcaster. Right. So we've kind of shrunk this last year in my new studio. I call it the Attic Studio. We went from 20,000 square feet to about 400. But it's still, thanks to technologies. Now it's Zoom, not Skype. But thanks to modern technologies, we're going to use Ecamm. I can do in my attic what it took a lot of people and a lot of expensive equipment to do in years gone by. You know that you're doing this in your office. It's really remarkable how times have changed.
It is remarkable. And I remember the very first podcast I did was in connection with the blog that I wrote a long time ago. As you were saying, RSS feeds were already part of what made blogs what they were. And then it just became, you know, I was friends with Dave Weiner, and not so much Adam Curry, but I knew who he was, and others. And Rick Clow, who went to go work for Feedburner. So he was very much entrenched. Yes, exactly. He was very much entrenched with RSS. So I was basically handheld along by some of these folks saying, hey, why don't you do a show in connection with your blog? And I literally recorded that on my Nokia phone because it was the only thing I owned that had a microphone and could record.
Wow.
And so I was
kind of come full circle. Yes. You could easily do a show on your iPhone these days.
You could easily do a show on your iPhone.
Audio and video would be amazing. Yeah.
But I love that with your background in television and transitioning out of tech TV, your thought at the time was, I can do TV. I just don't need TV production. I don't need TV infrastructure. I can be it. And then you did.
That was the initial goal was, how can I do this at a hundredth of the cost of Tech TV? Tech TV had two multi-million dollar studios, big facility in San Francisco. It was something only somebody, Paul Allen, owned it, and he's lost hundreds of millions of dollars building it. Only somebody like that could do. But with the, and this has been the story all along. This was the story in 2004. It's the story now. With the continual improvement in consumer electronics, the continual increase in bandwidth available to normal people, suddenly you don't need a TV station or radio station to be a broadcaster. Mm-hmm. Thanks to YouTube, it's completely democratized, which has its negatives as well. For people like me, I used to have, there were a handful of channels in the world. If you were on a cable channel, you had a major leg up. Now everybody has a show. So we have to compete now at this point on quality, I guess, and on saying something that people want to hear and are interested in. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. But it means that I no longer have the bully pulpit all to myself, shall we say.
No, and that's, I mean, I guess that's one of the hazards. Thing. Hazards of living out there on the bleeding edge, like you do, that at some point the masses catch up with the bleeding edge.
It's always moving. Yeah. So as we build this studio, it's just mind-boggling how many of the technologies we're going to use that are really aimed at everyday person on the street who wants to have a podcast. I'm going to use, I used to have, Telos gave us a $100,000 Axia audio system that was spread throughout the studio, had all this sophisticated stuff. Now I'm going to have a little $300 Rode podcaster that with little sliders on it.
Right.
That will do the same thing.
Yeah.
It'll get the job done. I'm going to be, we spent a whole lot of money. I thought this was cool. In a normal TV station, you have these pedestal cameras that each cost $100,000. I spent $100,000 and bought 40 camcorders, Canon Vixia camcorders. This was in 2015, 2014. And instead of having camera operators, we just put them everywhere and we would switch from camera to camera. And that gave you the movement and the different perspectives and so forth, instead of having a camera person moving around.
Right.
That saved us a lot of money, believe it or not. But now you don't even need that. I'm using an Insta360 camera that could follow me around. I've turned that off because it could be disconcerting. But if I move, I'll turn it on. You'll see.
Okay.
If I move, if I don't need a camera operator, it follows me everywhere.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So this is what's cool about technology. It never rests. And it is kind of incumbent on somebody who wants to stay. Look, if you're going to cover technology as we do, we can never rest. It's a constant, battle to stay with the times. But all of this is great. All of this is really good. The fact that I can do from my attic what I used to have to go to $1 million studio to do is just fantastic in the long run, I think.
Right. Do you have any inside anecdotes, spill the tea kinds of things from those early days when you were having folks come by the Screensavers set or come to your show that went on to found and then sell big networks like Twitter, now X.
Oh, interesting. You mean like, did I meet any unicorns before they were unicorns?
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
and what do you remember?
I've kind of blanked it out intentionally just because I don't want to think about the money that I've left on the table. But as a journalist, you can see, when zip drives came out, it was obvious this is going to be huge. This is, You got to be old even to remember what a zip disk is. But this is going to be huge because we used to have floppies. You felt good if you get 1.5 megabytes, megabytes on a disk. And the zip disk came out and you get 100 megabytes on a disk. It was pretty obvious that was going to be huge. We talked about it. We interviewed it. And a couple of years later, a guy drives up to an event I'm doing in a very, I think it was a Rolls Royce, a very nice car. Guy gets out and says, "You know, you bought me that car." I said, "I'm sorry, what?" He said, "You were talking about zip drives and how great they were. So I bought a lot of iOmega," was the company, "iOmega stock." And they had a very, just like NVIDIA is having now, they had a very, very fast run up. The only thing I said is, well, obviously you sold at the right time too, because as just as everything goes up, must come down.
Right.
So did iOmega. In fact, they're gone. They're defunct now.
It's but really telling that you just drew that parallel with NVIDIA.
That's the thing. And that's, I think, what us gray hairs, and I'm not including you, but my cohort of older tech journalists bring to the table is a memory of the cyclical nature of these events. We've seen this before. And so I think part of what I bring, I like to think I bring to the table, is the context to say, oh yeah, this is a big deal. This is not such a big deal. We've seen this before. We haven't seen this before. I remember talking to Ev Williams, who I knew from, you know, first he did Blogger. Everybody remembers Blogger and Blogspot. And that really empowered blogging, right? Yeah. And then Ev decided to, he thought podcasting's the next big thing. This is about 2004 or five. And he started a company called Odeo. And we were one of the handful of podcasts that was on it. And, you know, it was before Apple did iTunes podcasts. So it was really one of the few good ways to find podcasts and listen to them. But it didn't succeed because there was no money in it. So Ev gave the money back to the investors, which I thought was very classy, and started something, this little thing called Twitter. And I remember talking to him a few years afterwards. I love Twitter. You do too. We both used it a lot. And I said, congratulations on your success, but I'm kind of mad that you named it Twitter. You knew about Twit. Didn't you think there'd be some name collision here? And he said, yeah, but Leo, I didn't think either of us was going anywhere. So I didn't think it would matter if we use a similar name. He was wrong. And I've spent many, many years explaining to people Twit is not Twitter. I bet you there are people watching right now who are going, oh, I thought this was about Twitter. I don't care about Twit. So we've had to go through that. But, you know, the fun of it for me is watching these things happen, watching these cycles come and go. And the nice thing about it is it's not boring. You know, if it must be boring if you're, I don't know, a general reporter, or you cover, I don't know, the farm industry. There's not a lot of change. It's the same old, same old. Technology, the core of it is change. Everything's always changing. So, and it's important. It's not just kind of trivial stuff. This is important stuff, changing the world. And it's an important job to say, this is good, this is bad. Pay attention to this. Don't worry about that. Is, I think, a really important job. So I really love doing it. And, I hope I can keep doing it for as long as I can talk and have a little attic. I'll be doing that.
I think that's going to be quite a long time.
I hope so. I love it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're very kind to not lump me in with what you called the old guard of technology journalists, but I've been around for a long time too. I'm only slightly younger than you are. And one thing-
That's not true, but okay.
Yes, it is.
You're quite a bit young. But you know, the thing is, technology, everything's compressed, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you say unevenly distributed, well, something that is the future this year will be the present in a year. Right. It happens really, really fast. So you don't have to be really old to have seen a lot of change. My first computer was an Atari 400 and running a 6502 chip. I've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And things have gotten a lot better and they've changed a lot. But they've also, in some ways, as Cory Doctorow says, got a lot worse. He uses a cruder phrase for that, but you know
yes.
what I'm talking about.
Yes, he does. I do indeed. And if those listening don't know the phrase, Look up Cory Doctorow. I believe he's at least written an article and possibly a book with that title, right?
He's also, it became the word of the year last year, according to, I think it was the American Dictionary Association or something.
Yes.
So it is a word that is now, that's the other thing that's really cool. I mean, I know the guy who invented the hashtag, right?
Right.
You know, Chris Messina. Before, you know, people thought, well, there must have always been a hashtag Me Too. No. The hashtag was made up. Chris made it up. Twitter adopted it. It became a thing. I met the guy who invented the at sign in your email. Somebody had to invent all that stuff.
Right.
And the thing is, they're mostly my contemporaries or even younger than me. So I've watched this. I'll never forget on the Screensavers getting a guy named Doug Engelbart on.
Yes.
Doug is famous for doing what's called the mother of all demos. And this was in the 70s, maybe the late 60s. He was at Xerox PARC, and they had invented the graphic user interface, menus and windows, and they used this weird thing called a mouse. He invented the mouse to control it. And I remember having him on the Screensavers. He's passed since then, but I knew that it was important we get these people on to tell the story while they were still around. He brought in that wooden mouse, the first wooden mouse that he used in that mother of all demos. And, that's history. That to see that is mind-boggling. I also worked for many years with John C. Dvorak, who said, nobody wants a mouse. What's a mouse? Get rid of the mouse.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to meet Doug Engelbart as well. And
nice.
Such a sweet person. And there is this surreal night of my life I will never forget. I attended the first D All Things Digital conference.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
In
that was going to be a big thing, wasn't it? You were at the beginning.
It was a big thing. And just that conference itself, the cast of characters, the luminaries who attended that were.
Those red chairs are in
over
the Smithsonian.
Top.
They're in the Smithsonian now. I hope someday that my Dr. Evil chair will be in the Smithsonian.
I will do my darndest to make sure that happens. But I drove to that event because I live in Southern California. Meanwhile,
oh, cool.
These people were flying in from everywhere
all
like they
the
do for the Allen event in Sun Valley.
That's right.
And there's an airstrip very close to where the event took place. So people could fly in privately if that was their deal. But people didn't have a car. And I had a great big Dodge Durango that could seat seven people and me. And, you know, the hotel was lovely and there was food at the hotel, but by a couple days into the event, people were getting a little stir crazy. And I was standing there with Dan Bricklin, the inventor, the co-inventor, I think, of the spreadsheet. And Doug Engelbart and gosh, I don't even remember who else was in this ambit, but it was
pretty important pioneers.
We filled up my car and went and got tacos.
Wow. See, maybe you are an old timer. You knew all those people. Yeah.
I met them.
I think that's one of the things I've always thought was an important part of our job at TWiT was, and before that Tech TV, was to talk to these people.
Mm-hmm.
People even maybe that aren't well known in the general public, but who are the inventors of the future, the people who are changing the world, doing these amazing things. You might tell your mom, hey, I met Doug Engelbart. I was hanging out with Dan Bricklin. And she might say, oh, and who are they? But it's important, I think, for us to know who it is and to tell people who it is and to talk to them so that there's a record. I've interviewed Linus Torvalds several times, very sweet, unassuming guy, who really didn't know the degree, at least when I interviewed him back in Tech TV, and that was probably 2002 or 2003, Linux was 10 years old, had no idea the degree to which he was changing the world.
Right. And for those who aren't familiar, Linux is an open source operating system like the OSs that run Windows machines and Apple-based machines.
You're using it right now, whether you know it or not. I'm sure this software is running on Linux. Every website, or at least 3/4 of all the websites in the world, run on Linux. And every Android phone is running on Linux. Android is Linux with a layer on top. Chrome OS is Linux. So I would say without a doubt, wrote, and this is the important part, gave away the dominant operating system in 2024. I mean, it is easily the number one operating system in the world. And he just gave it away. He didn't, it's a remarkable story. What an incredible guy.
Well, and back in those days, there was so much optimism about technology's role in society and what it was going to do for us. And this was even before you and I met and you started twit.tv. It was when people were first being able to connect with one another across distances and time in ways that they hadn't before. And I think we all, gazing ahead from there, thought, gee, this is so amazing. And it's just going to revolutionize and change the world so much for the better. And it has in ways, but gazing back now, we know everything wasn't rosy,
right?
And not everybody got all the benefits that we could see coming down the pipe, and the harms and dangers fell harder on some than on others. I still think there's been an overall positive impact that sometimes gets overlooked or swept under the rug or just taken it for granted. Do you agree?
Yeah, I really don't want to be seen as a cheerleader for technology, like mm-hmm. Wide-eyed, oh, this is the best thing ever. But I also feel it's important to defend technology. And I think you nailed it, because technology by itself is neither good nor bad. It's how we as humans use it. And we are a mixture of good and bad, every one of us. So I really think at this point, when you have the Surgeon General of the United States saying we ought to put a warning label on social media, states around the country doing things to control social media, to ban it, to assault Section 230, which makes it possible even to have a social medium, I think it's important to defend it also. So I'm not a cheerleader in the sense that everything that happens on the internet is good. But I think it's really important to remember what a transformational tool this has been. We couldn't do what we're doing right now if it weren't for all of these amazing technologies. I think that is a net good. And when there is bad stuff, and there's lots of it, you got to remember, it's not the technology. It's the people who use the technology that are problematic. You know, we were talking before the show. I have over here, I call it a badge tree, but it's probably 30 years worth of conference badges. And as I was hanging that up this morning, I thought, I haven't been to a conference in ages. This used to be how we would get together.
Yes.
We don't have to anymore. Now that is not necessarily a good thing. We don't have face-to-face as much face-to-face. You're not going to get to go to tacos with Dan Bricklin and Doug Engelbart if you mm-hmm. don't go to a conference. But at the same time, just as you said, people from all over the world now, people who would never otherwise see each other, can communicate, can get to know one another. It does break down boundaries.
Yeah.
So it's just that things change. And change, again, is not inherently good or bad. It's up to us. It's really up to us as humans to make it good or bad. And we need to remember that, so that we don't just say, well, it's all because of technology. If we just get rid of technology, it'll all be better. That's not the case. It's us. We have met the enemy, as Pogo said.
Yeah.
And he is us.
As you think about yourself back in the early 2000s and what you knew then and how you thought about tech then, was there anything at that time that you were worried about or hesitant about that wound up being bad? Or is there anything you can think of that you think we really should have understood that this needed more oversight or care yeah. or control? And you just slap your forehead going, how did we not know?
Yeah. We talk about this a lot on our shows, especially on This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis is a historian of technology and is a strong advocate for protecting the internet, protecting technology. I think I was a very bullish optimist in the early 2000s when I was at Tech TV. Mm-hmm. What we were then, which was appropriate for the time, is a group of people who understood technology, understood its potential for good, and wanted to let everybody know about it. I've always thought of my mission statement as being a translator as somebody who understands technology, explaining what it does and how it can be used to people who don't yet, it's to give people the tools to make their life better and to change the world. That's a really important thing. And even then, I thought, you know, that's what we're up to. But what has happened is we have had to temper it because we've also seen, you know, the pile-ons, the flame wars. But, you know, we had flame wars on the Usenet back in the 90s. I mean, it's wherever there are people and wherever people get together, there is conflict. That's just the human way of life, I guess. And I'm not less bullish about technology, but I did at the time think, gosh, you know, if everybody has a voice, that will be the ultimate democratizing force. That YouTube and Twitter and all those other tools give people a chance to be heard. And I come from a background in mass media, you know, in broadcasting, where it's only a handful of people who are heard, mm-hmm. right? Now everybody can be heard. And I thought that that's going to be an obvious good. And what I underestimated, and in hindsight, I probably should have known, is, yeah, it gives everybody a voice, the good and the bad. It, you now know, you know, a lot more Nazis than you used to know. And, but you know, they were probably always there. So now they're out from under the rock. Is that a bad thing? You know, it isn't a bad thing as long as we continue to say, no.
Right.
No. Maybe they feel a little bit more empowered. I still believe fundamentally that the more you know, the better. Ignorance is not bliss. And so, yeah, we now know a lot more about how bad humans can be, don't we? But that gives us a chance to be better.
I agree. And we have more transparency into all kinds of institutions that were pretty closed off from scrutiny before, whether it's...
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Although I worry about journalism. One unintended consequence of the rise of the internet is it's the traditional journalistic enterprises are just, they're not funded anymore. Mm-hmm. When everybody's a newspaper, what does it mean to be a newspaper?
Right.
That by itself isn't bad, but you still need people who care enough to go and cover the city council meeting and the school board meeting. The basic stuff of journalism still needs to be done. And there's so much noise now. Yet, do we really know what's going on in government? We know a lot more, but do we really know the truth? I don't know. I think we need people. We desperately need people we can trust who can ferret out the truth. It's probably better that it's not just a handful of newspapers now, but it does make it harder for us to figure out what's reliable and what's not.
Well, maybe part of the answer to my next question here is figuring out a way to shore up journalism and journalistic institutions as they continue to be bombarded. But I was wondering, as we sit here today, what you think it's most important that we continue to foster and develop and move forward on as far as technology goes, and as we sit here today, what you're hesitant about, worried about, what gives you pause?
I think one thing that we now know that we didn't know before, everything was free at first on the internet. And we just thought, well, that's the way it is. What we now know is nothing's free. Everything costs. Facebook's not free. Gmail's not free. You have to pay. And we have decided, we've realized that we don't really like the way that we've been paying with surveillance and surveillance capitalism and you know, the lack of privacy and the targeted advertising and all that stuff. I think people don't like it very much. So I think we need to really start to recognize that the stuff that we use and the stuff we like isn't free, costs money. And we really have to think about maybe starting to support it with financially so that we don't have to support it with our privacy. I think that that's been over the last few years, that's been a real eye opener for everybody. People are aware of it. Unfortunately, there is a large group of people who say, I don't want surveillance. I don't want targeted advertising, and I don't want to pay. Well, that's not viable. That's not tenable because the blogs you read, the podcasts you listen to, they cost money to make, and the people who make them need to make a living so they can eat. And so we need to find a way for that to work. That is a big, big challenge that's coming our way. And I think it's just, we kind of bought a premise that isn't true, which is that, oh, it's all free.
Right. There was one development in the mid 2000s that was a warning sign that I don't think any of us really realized what was going to follow in its footsteps. But you and I've talked about it before. It was called People PC, which was, you know, I forgot about that. Yeah, it was
a free PC,
just as computers were starting to be not just in everybody's office, but in everybody's home and increasingly necessary for everybody's children to get their education. Some company came along and decided we're going to give you a free PC, but the trade-off is you're the price. Right. You know, we're tracking everything you do on that PC. Right. Your data is our data. And they failed ultimately. You don't see people PCs around. But I mean, that was so the harbinger of Google's business model, social media business models, everything that was to come. And I remember at the time thinking, ew. This isn't a good idea.
But there are people who do it. Honestly, there's, you know, every time my wife turns on Honey or Rakuten or Camel, 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 I say, well, you know that that's free because it's following you around. She pulls out the Rakuten check and says, yeah, and I love it. So, but that's good in a way because that's an explicit trade.
Yeah.
They're saying, we're going to send you a check. And give you coupons, you're going to save money. But I think it's widely understood that the way we make that work is we tell the advertisers and the companies everything about you. If you're willing to make that trade, that's fine. That's one of the ways we can support the internet. The other way is going to be, you know, forking over some dough. This comes up for us because as a podcast for years, we're advertiser supported. And that's not really working anymore. And so a couple of years ago, we started to go to our audience and say, you know, can you contribute? We have a club and we try to give them benefits and stuff. But it's very difficult to get people to pay for something they got for free for a long time. I think psychologically, it just doesn't work. And there are very few newspapers people are willing to pay for. The New York Times, but maybe that's because they're paying for Wordle or the crossword puzzles. Maybe the Washington Post, but certainly the Wall Street Journal. They've always had a very thriving paywall. And I think that's because people say, well, I need this. It makes me money. This is
right.
This is for my business.
Right.
So I think it's also important. We need great writing, great journalism. Maybe it doesn't make you money, but it's important for our lives. Maybe we need to support that as well.
Right. At that D All Things Digital conference I attended, Steve Jobs was one of the people they interviewed at that conference one. Mm-hmm. And Kara and Walt, I forget if it was Kara or Walt, but one of them asked him what the biggest challenge he and Steve Wozniak faced at the beginning of making Apple Computer. What was their biggest business challenge? And I'll never forget that Steve Jobs said, people couldn't type. We knew that death would eventually take care of this. And he was so right. But I feel the reason I bring it up is I feel like there are still, as we sit here today, people who can't type. They're getting older, but my mom is one of them, for example. And we subscribe to the paper version of the New York Times so that you said people subscribe to the Wall Street Journal so they can make money. We subscribe to the New York Times for my mother for her mental health.
Yeah.
So she has good information coming her way, and arts and entertainment and, you know, the whole depth and variety of that newspaper.
That's a good thing. I subscribe to the Sunday Times for my mom too.
Right.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. But as Steve Jobs said, death will eventually take care of this.
I guess the problem is this is moving so fast that even 10 years is a lifetime in technology. So mm-hmm. people were born 10 years later than my kids. My kids are in their 30s now. People in their 20s have a very different perspective and a very different take on all this. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
My kids used to mock me because I use punctuation in my text messages to them. Today, kids will mock you because you use words. So
I get it all. Punctuation, words. I am so antiquated as far as my child is concerned.
The Wozniak and Jobs are fascinating. I've spent a lot of time with Woz. I consider him a good friend and a really sweet guy. I'm more like him. He did it because for the love of it, for the knowledge, because he wanted to make something great. He wanted people to use something great. He told me once, he didn't really talk about it much in public, but he said, every time I would invent something or come up with a new idea, Steve Jobs would say, oh, we can make a business out of that. Whether it was blue boxes for hacking, the Apple One computer, Steve was very much focused on how you can make money on these things and was very good at marketing these things. But Woz, and I'm frankly more in Woz's camp, Woz wasn't worried about that. Woz just wanted to make something neat. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to do something cool. And he loved it that people liked to play with it. And he just has this wonderful kind of state of mind about technology that I personally prefer. It's really sad to me. I watched the rise and fall, maybe the rise again of cryptocurrency and of Bitcoin. And it made me sad because that isn't technology to improve people's lives. You could say it is, but really the success of Bitcoin is people think they can make money on it. It's pure and simple. And I don't think greed is ever a good reason to do anything. Especially invent technologies, create technologies, promote technologies. And I think we've gone a little bit wrong in the last few years with technologies that don't improve people's lives. And I know, I mean, there's people listening who go, well, this is going to help the unbanked in the third world and so forth. No, mm-hmm. no, it's not. And it hasn't.
Yeah.
But it's made a lot of people accidental billionaires.
Right. Well, I mean, speaking of our children ridiculing us because we're so far behind the way they use technology, you and I often have a similar response, I suspect, when we see some of the tech leaders show up in Congress, in hearings in Washington, and have to answer questions put to them by our aging lawmakers who, you know, our children who wouldn't even be able to text our children, right? That they're just not tech savvy enough to even use the words in punctuation and look goofy because they do. If you could set some of our elected representatives straight on just three things about technology that they don't adequately understand as we sit here today, what would those things be?
The very first thing I do is bring back the Office of Technology Information. I think that was the name of it. Newt Gingrich got rid of it, and it was a huge mistake. This was a nonpartisan group, kind of like the Government Accounting Office, that would provide information to members of Congress, background information about technologies. They needed it. Everybody needs it. I don't expect people in Congress to have any more grasp of technology than the average person on the street, but they had a tool that would make it possible for them to learn about it. That's got to come back. I can't remember the exact name, the Office of Technology Information, something like that. So that's number one. I think these are intelligent people, but I think they somewhat lack information. They're totally reliant on their staff. And if the staff isn't up and current and with it, they're not. It's possible to be. Ron Wyden is very mm-hmm. good. He has very good staff. He has Chris Segoyan on his staff. He has very good people telling him about technology. Every member of Congress deserves that level of information. I would also, of course, tell them to knock it off at Section 230. A lot of times what happens, and it's really interesting to watch this happen, is policymakers conflate technology with big technology. They don't like Google, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon. They are going after them, but they say, so, you know, they want to get rid of things like Section 230 because it's used by these big companies and Twitter to whatever, squash speech. But what they don't understand is that Section 230 applies to everybody. And it, and big technology, if you make, if you remove Section 230 of the Communications Act, they will survive because they can afford lawyers by the dozens.
Yeah.
Well, the people will suffer, and you know this very well, is people like me who have forums and Mastodon instances and chat rooms. That's important to what I do. It's a way that everybody can communicate. Section 230 of the Communications Act protects me. This is a part of the 1996 Communications Act, thanks to Ryan Wyden for it and a few other people who saw the future, who basically said, you're not liable for content posted on your social network. The people who posted are liable, but you're not liable for that. And you should furthermore be able to delete it if you want. You aren't liable for that either. It's your, you know, you should be allowed to control your own platform. If suddenly I'm liable for whatever anybody posts on my chat room or my Mastodon instance or our forums, I'm going to shut them down because I don't have the resources to defend myself against lawsuits. And so these members of Congress who are against Section 230, and it, by the way, includes President Biden, it includes the Republican Party. Nobody seems to like Section 230 for a variety of different reasons. Those people don't understand. Facebook will survive. Twitter will survive. They have the power to defend themselves. What you're going to really do is knock the real conversation off that's going on in small groups everywhere all over the country. Right. And that's terrible. You know this better than anybody. You're the ones who taught me about Section 230. So I wish that they would learn that lesson, and maybe even the larger lesson that big technology, the FANG is not the be all and end all of technology. There's a lot of little guys around that need to be protected too, maybe more than anybody else.
Right. Okay. Is there a third thing that you would set Congress straight on? Those are good ones.
Yeah. Let me think. What could I set? There's so many things I would set Congress straight on, but this is about technology.
In your particular area of expertise.
What do they need to know about technology that they don't understand?
Well, how about, I mean, I feel like, of course, we haven't even, and I am very proud of you and I, and I'm patting both of us on the back for not mentioning AI in this episode of this show until right now. But of course, it is... the constant elephant in the room as we talk about.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
3 years ago, you would have said crypto.
Mm-hmm.
5 years ago, you would have said social media. There's always going to be the next thing. So let's give them a tool that transcends any one particular kind of technology. What they need to, they need to be educated. And that's why I'm big on this Office of Technology Information.
Yeah.
But they also need to understand that, as I said earlier, technology is morally neutral. It's people that are the problem. And when you start to blame technologies, whatever kinds of technology, let's use AI as an example. When you start to say, oh no, AI is not the problem. It's what people do with AI that's potentially the problem. And maybe you shouldn't, you know, create autonomous killing machines. I'm just saying, you know, the AI is not good enough for that yet. Mm-hmm. I would just say, stop blaming the technology and start paying attention to what the real problem is.
Yeah. Excellent advice. So we've talked about a lot of history, and we've talked about how you've lived in the future for a long time. How do you think you most live in the future right now?
I think that the idea that I could do this job that I've done for 50 years as a broadcaster, mm-hmm. without ever stepping out of my house.
Yeah.
It's remarkable. You know, and already that transformation happened in radio many, many years ago. Very few of the radio hosts, if you still listen to the radio, nobody does. But if somebody listens to the radio, very few of them actually are in a studio anymore. They're almost all doing it from their house. And that's been happening a long time ago on radio, but it's starting to happen in TV as well. In fact, if you watch the news networks, only the anchors are in a studio. Everybody else that's on with them is in their kitchen.
Right.
And that all started because of COVID, but you know, COVID stopped and we didn't go back to the studio. So I'm kind of blown away by the, it's fun. I've been having a great time. I'm ordering all this stuff and we're setting this all up. And you know, when we built our last studio, the revelation was, oh, you don't need to buy professional lighting gear because there's so much great LED stuff now, especially stuff made for discos or whatever they call them, nightclubs, that you don't need to buy these expensive professional gear. Well, I'm not even buying disco stuff anymore. I mean, we've come a long way in terms of technology. Some of that, by the way, is because of China and Apple. I thought of another thing.
Okay.
It really bugs me that we start to say, oh, we can't have anything from China anymore, or we can't have anything from Russia anymore. The best path to world peace is economic cooperation and economic dependency. If countries are economically intertwined and interdependent, they can't make war on one another. Mm-hmm. So the best way to keep Russia and China and all our so-called enemies from attacking us is to keep doing business with them. You know, you can do it aggressively and you can make sure that they pay their fair share of tariffs or whatever, but that economic interdependency is very, very important. And so members of Congress who are quick to, you know, look, for a politician, enemies are very important. You know, we know this from George Orwell's 1984. You always have to have the other, because that's what gets people excited and riled up and gets them to the polls. Well, slow your horses here. Do you really want to go to war with China? I don't think so. So let's maybe dial down the rhetoric and try to find ways that we can work together, you know. And right. That, by the way, we used to say we are the beacon of democracy in the world. We're not maybe the best example of democracy anymore. The best way to give people freedoms, to liberate them, is to be a shining beacon on the hill. Let's get back to that. You know, let's live our values with integrity instead of being so, you know, anxious to get power and to get money. We have an opportunity as a country to show them how to do it right. And I think that for a long time, the United States really was that beacon of hope, and walls were falling. I think the walls are coming back up now, which makes me very sad.
Right. And just from a practical standpoint, I don't know, in some ways, maybe it's good that China is developing its own electric vehicle technology, smartphone technology, sort of side by side along with our developments, or maybe piggybacking on our developments, since so much of our stuff is manufactured there and they have.
Well, that was my original point. Yeah. Was all of this consumer technology I'm using not only is made in China, but is made in China because Apple went to China to get the iPhone made and taught them all these new engineering skills. And now we've got drones and we've got little cameras. We've got all sorts of stuff that is really just because they learned from us how to make this stuff. And they decided they wanted to be the world's factory. That's not necessarily a bad thing. We could do it too. We can do it too.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the benefit we're getting today, a lot of the stuff I'm using, pretty much everything I'm using right now is made in China.
Yeah. It seems like one of the things we've both witnessed are in our intersections with the world of technology are game-changing developments where the world is different after for example, Steve Jobs gets on stage and unveils whatever the next big thing was. And then everything was different the next day and for months to come and years to come. And it feels like we've moved away from that and that things develop much more incrementally and in
an AI.
Okay.
Not with AI. I think AI, one of the reasons AI is exciting to me, and I'm still not sure, the jury's still out. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons it's exciting to me is because for the first time in many years, we were surprised.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, it works. It's doing stuff. Wow. We didn't expect that. It's useful. AI, yeah. I think, has the potential, maybe it won't, maybe it will, but it has the potential to be as transformative as the iPhone.
Right.
And it's happening very rapidly. You remember a year ago, you'd use these image generating AIs and there'd be 18 fingers and everything would be weird looking. That's not a problem anymore. It's gotten really good. Now the problem is, how can we tell the difference?
Yeah.
That's pretty fast in 1 year.
It is. You're absolutely right. We've talked a little bit about you and I getting older, our parents getting older, our parents' generation being less tech savvy than our generations and certainly our kids. Looking at the way that technology can enhance people's lives or back to your radio show, frustrate the hell out of them. What's your personal experience with older people that you know and technology? Do you think it's helping them? Do you think developments that we see today not only will assist them to live, you know, more pleasant daily lives, but maybe lead longer and more productive lives?
You know, it's a mixed bag. My mom's in a nursing home. She's 91.
Mm-hmm.
She's got Alzheimer's. She's kind of a little confused about what's going on, what's in reality. But I'm able to FaceTime her on a regular basis. And it's like I'm there. It's like visiting. I'm able to order a box of chocolates for her every week, which she really takes great pleasure in. So, you know, and it comes in a truck and a guy gives it to her. I mean, there's definitely, we're starting to see some really interesting things. She's able to, you know, I got her a picture frame, a digital picture frame, and I put all the family slides on there. And as she's having memory issues, it's really wonderful for her to see these old pictures, which she remembers perfectly, of course, because her older memories are intact. And she loves it. She says, I won't go to sleep every night without looking at those pictures and those memories. So there's some really wonderful things that technology is bringing us as older people. I imagine at some point things like the Vision Pro will allow people who are not particularly mobile or not able to get out of the house to travel the world to do interesting things. We're not there yet, but I think that may happen sometime soon. I also think it's unfair to say that older people don't embrace or know about technology. It is true, as we get older, we get more hidebound in our ways and we don't embrace change. But I'm 67. I'll be 68 this year. I'm an old person and I love technology and I know how to use it. And I celebrate it. So I think there are plenty of people in my age bracket who are that way. Yeah. So I think it's probably not good to paint them with a particular brush.
Sure.
And for people like my mom, who is not, you know, she has an iPad. She's always had, you know, I've made sure she's always had a lot of modern technology. She has Eero's at home and, you know, all sorts of stuff. She always embraced it. She loved it. She never had a problem with it.
Yeah.
She wasn't particularly adept with it. But she knew how to type.
Right. And my mom, who doesn't know how to type and still will not like write an email or write a text because she has an iPhone now. And she can tap, but she can't type, if that makes sense.
Right.
So what I found really heartwarming recently is our family took a trip. And there was a little highlight video from the trip that I sent to all the grandparents who didn't come along with us. It was this 11-minute long video that sort of recapped what we'd been up to. And I shared it in an album on iPhotos. And most of the grandparents still have not looked at that video. My mom tapped it and watched it.
Right on. Right
and
on.
And she loved it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course she did.
Right.
And by the way, that's network quality production.
Yeah.
If you ever watch a football game from the 90s, that's not that long ago. The quality of production has gone so far, and we're able in our own houses on our phone to do stuff that's so much better than the networks could do 20 years ago. So it's pretty cool. It's very empowering. I mean, I look at my son who's you know, using modern technology to create little videos that are very popular. It's remarkable.
Yeah. And I assume lucratively for him.
Very lucrative. He makes more money than I do. And he has more followers than I do. Damn him. No, it's actually one of the greatest joys of my life is that he is now more famous than I am.
Yes. And if people are not familiar with him, I absolutely love Henry Laporte's social media presence. Yes.
Salt Hank. It's funny because Paris Martineau, I do a show with, she's in her 20s. We do This Week in Google together. And she was at the beach with her other 20 something friends. And she was telling them about the show she does with this guy named Leo Laporte. They had no idea. She said, it's Salt Hank's dad. And they went, you know Salt Hank?
Oh my God, you've become Salt Hank's dad.
I love that. I'm thrilled. It couldn't be better. I'm just really happy.
That's awesome.
So, but that's something he did with he couldn't have done without TikTok and modern video technology, editing technology. I mean, it's really remarkable. Mm-hmm. What one person can do now and reach an audience of many millions.
And it's really, I can't watch it on an empty stomach because the things he creates, these incredibly delectable sandwiches mostly, but other things too.
Well, wait till you see his cookbook. He's got lots of stuff. He's got a salt business now, the Salt Lovers Club. And he's about to branch off into pickles and pickled peppers and pickled onions. So watch for that in a store near you.
Well, he very much seems to have followed your example of deeply and tightly incorporating his passions with his professional pursuits, which is something that I think you've done ever since you were in college.
What I always said to him is do what you love, the money will follow.
Yeah.
Which was probably terrible advice, but that's what I always said to him. And it worked out. It's good.
And do you think that applies broadly to his generation and others in our country, in the world?
I see people who hate their jobs and I feel so terrible for them that you have to get up every day and go to something you hate just because you need to eat. And I just wish that people had the faith in themselves to do something that they really care about. It's my belief that if you're passionate about whatever it is and you really care about it, you will communicate that passion. And now they have so many ways to do that, so many tools to do that, and will be successful. You don't have to go to a 9-to-5 job. You can follow your passion. And honestly, I think that's a more authentic way to live. And I think it is available to everybody. I do. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel that way. And it worked out. You know, my daughter is not quite as successful trying to be a stand-up comic. That's a hard road. She knows it, but she's pursuing it. She gets up every day and gets on the open mic because she loves it. And I think that that's how you become successful. That's the key.
We've touched on some of this already, but I wanted to get your take in sort of a spontaneous way of your thoughts about what's next in some areas that you've either had direct experience with or observational experience with. For example, journalism. What do you think we'll see happen there?
Such a frustration and sadness that I have. But it's clear that we had to clear the way. We had to clear the decks. The print journalism wasn't fast enough, just wasn't going to serve in the modern world. Broadcast journalism has absolutely failed us because just like every other form of broadcast, they've realized, well, if you want to get the big audiences, you got to be sensational. And unfortunately, the problem with sensationalism is it constantly has to be ratcheted up because what was sensational yesterday is just ho-hum today. So you got, and it's just, as a result, broadcast media my medium, radio, but television too, has just gone down the tubes. So it is my hope that the future of journalism is going to be committed individuals who have integrity, who use these platforms like TikTok. There's a guy I just read about. He's from El Salvador. He does Latin American news on TikTok, 9 million followers. And if there's an important story, immigration story for Latino Americans, or an important story for them in other areas, he will, as many times a day, just get up, go on TikTok and post it and get millions of views. That's a form of journalism that's really important. It speaks to people where they are in a way they want to be spoken to. And I think that that's the hope of journalism, that there will be ways to do it. He makes a good living, by the way, more than $1 million a year with brand deals and so forth. There will be ways to do it that you can support yourself. And I just hope that the consuming public learns the difference between true, valid, authentic journalism and, persuasive journalism, propaganda,
right,
lies. If they get better at that, there are plenty of people out there who will tell true stories and tell truth to power. And there'll be more of them than ever. So there's a real opportunity here.
And if we shift gears from information and news to entertainment and creativity, like what your son and daughter are engaged in, does it look similar? Are today's influencers tomorrow's Spielbergs?
Yes, but they won't necessarily be making 2-hour movies.
Yeah.
The mediums are changing incredibly. The people who are native to the media, to the medium, to will be the ones who will use it effectively. Every day there's some new way of expressing yourself. There's never been a better time to be a creator. And the fact that creators can reach directly to their audiences is phenomenal. We don't need more Ticketmasters and Live Nations and record companies in between us and artists. There are very great talented people who now have a way to reach their audience. It's a little unsettled. That's always the case when new things happen. Everything gets shaken up. All the incumbents have fallen by the wayside. We don't understand what's going on. That's a huge opportunity. I think this is the best time ever to be a creator.
And for those who aren't creative but have some spare time and maybe increasing spare time on their hands as AI starts to perform more and more of our daily drudgery, what do you think is the future of things like gaming and fitness and travel?
Oh, wow. Well, it's all the same, right? If you look at Apple's Fitness Plus, if you want to be fit, you can get fit. They're, mm-hmm. At no cost to you, but that's always been true. Fitness is easy to do. Travel, I'm worried about because everybody travels now and Instagram has ruined travel as everybody competes to traipse through the lavender fields and get the perfect picture in Provence. It's ruined it for everybody else. So I don't exactly know what the future of leisure is,
mm-hmm.
but I think just as there's huge opportunity for creators, there is equal opportunity in fun in leisure and having a good time.
Right.
I think we are in a very exciting time. The potential is huge, and honestly, follow your passion wherever it leads you.
Well, one leisure activity that I know you love is reading. And I'm wondering, too, I didn't lump that in with the future of literature, but I suppose there's some peril there from the incorporation of AI tools. And are we going to be okay with something that's co-authored or assisted by a large language model?
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm foolish. I really think there's a big difference between true human inspired human creation mm-hmm. and machine creation. There's just a gulf the machine can't cross. And so far I'm not wrong on this. Yeah. Humans do your best work. You will always be better than a machine. And humans opt for the best work you can listen to or read or watch or look at. Look for the human in it, because if it connects with you, it's human. A machine cannot connect with you because a machine has no lived experience. I really think that that will always be true.
And is there a particular author or book that has particularly shaped your worldview?
Oh, it just comes and goes. Right now I'm reading Dan Simmons' Hyperion trilogy, and it's just wonderful. It's funny. I went through a period of not wanting to read any sci-fi because it wasn't real. I wanted to read reality. I think I just finished Robert Caro's The Power Broker, and I really loved it. I still think that's one of the best books I've ever read. I'm trying to read his, so far, 5 volumes, soon to be 6, biography of Lyndon Johnson. That's a little bit slower going, still wonderfully written. So I go back and forth. I'm loving Hyperion. I'm almost through with it. The three volumes, I probably will stop with sci-fi, and I love history. You know what? There's way too many books to read and not nearly enough time.
Right.
Thank goodness for audiobooks, because that really helps me a lot. I can listen. Oh, I have speakers in here and I can listen while I'm doing stuff.
I love them too. And I love the community aspect of reading, of being part of a book club and unpacking the authors.
We have a book club on our network with Stacey Higginbotham. I think it's really fun.
Yeah.
She's making me read stuff I would never read, which is good. I'm getting a new perspective. She likes cozy books. I don't like cozy,
but that's what a book club is if you, take turns suggesting what the group's going to read, you're going to have your eyes and perspectives opened a bit. That's one thing. And we're going through right now. I have an older family member who has COVID right now. The president of the United States has COVID right now. We're going through a little summer wave of COVID spreading again. And we haven't really touched on the impact of the pandemic on the TWIT network and the impact of the TWIT network on those experiencing the pandemic. But it was super critical, I think, for a lot of us in the community around the TWIT network, that number one, you kept doing shows. Number two, you did creative things like watch parties for what with Tiger King, on Netflix. And
Lisa will never forgive me for that.
But it gave people a lifeline, I think, to be able to.
Well, we're people, so yeah. And I think that COVID has definitely changed. One of the reasons I'm up here in the attic now is because of COVID. Mm-hmm. It really, we've had to shrink significantly because of COVID.
Yeah,
COVID's has changed every aspect of people's lives. Maybe it was going to happen anyway. I don't know. But this is the way history happens, right?
So you've already made all these pivots in response to what you had to live through then. And God forbid this should happen. But if something like this, either COVID ramps up again or something else out of the blue comes at us, is there anything you have done that's sort of forward looking to try and anticipate getting through it better than you did the first time?
We've embraced work from home, and the technologies have made it possible. So one of the reasons we can close the studio and I can do my show from the attic is all of our staff, thanks to modern technology, is going to be able to do their jobs at home as well. Mm-hmm. That's good for, in a way we're quarantining before there's even a virus.
Yeah.
But we're going to have social events every month and, try to get everybody together.
Oh, good.
I'm very much going to miss that collegial bond that we have when we go into the studio and we're all working together towards the same goal. That's, but I feel like this is the future, right? We're moving into the future. And so the future is a little bit more disjointed. So what, for me personally, I'm going to do is make sure I have a local community that I can hang out with.
Yeah.
Try to replace that wonderful community I had at the studio with people in other areas. But at the same time, we're going to build our club and build our global community. And I want to do more things. One of the things this studio will give me, the capability of flipping a switch and just going on the air. And I expect to do that a lot more ad hoc.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's happening, at least to my area of podcasting, is we're going away from specific shows mm-hmm. into something a little more nebulous and amorphous, and maybe just kind of hanging out on camera. Right.
Like an Instagram live or whatever.
Yeah. Alex Lindsay has really taught me this with his office hours. He's sitting in that chair several hours every morning, just talking about stuff, and people come in and they answer questions. I think we're going to do a lot more of that. I think that's what's happening to Twit. It's turning into a community as opposed to a network of shows.
That's excellent.
We'll see how it works.
Okay, well, we're running out of time, but I can't wrap up this show without asking you to step back and look ahead. A big picture view of humanity's future. Are you as optimistic as you used to be? Are you hesitant? Do you have apprehension? And if so, is there one practical thing you could leave our listeners with that they could think about or do in their daily lives to help us have a better future?
You know, it's funny. Sometimes I'm very sad about the future. I think about climate change. I think about the growth of right-wing fascism everywhere in the world. I think about the income inequality, the growth in poverty, and the seeming increase in selfishness in those who have towards those who do not. And it's sad. It makes me sad and it scares me about the future. But then I remember that humans are remarkable, that we do best in tough times. And I think that the key thing for all of us to remember is that we are part of a larger community, to be kind to one another, to support one another. And this isn't specifically technology focused, but it can be. I mean, if one of the communities I'm in is a community of technology lovers, technology enthusiasts, if we can be kind to one another and support one another, especially in those times when some of us are down or are suffering, I think we can make it through whatever is about to happen. I do feel that we have difficult times ahead, but I think in difficult times, humans often rise to the occasion, and I'm counting on that.
Well, I can't think of a finer note to end on. Leo Laporte, thank you so much for joining me today on the Hearsay Culture Network. My show, Uneven Distribution, comes out twice a month. You can subscribe at hearsayculture.com or in your podcast listening tool of choice. We're so glad that you've joined us. Please email me. I'm Denise at hearsayculture.com with any thoughts you may have about this show or other shows, any feedback on the network. We are just so glad that you've joined us here today. And I couldn't be more thrilled, Leo, that you've taken the time to give us all of your insights here today on the show.
Well, I love you, Denise. It's so great to talk to you. We've had such a great time over the last 20 years. Here's to 20 more.
Here's to 20 more.
I like that.
All right. I hope to see you soon. Bye-bye.